ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why do humans hold on to stuff? Oddments we don't use and yet can't quite throw out. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? I'm Annabelle Crabb. Come and have a rummage through the story of us told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Is Ukraine turning the tide?
After 4 years in the trenches, advances in missiles have put it in the strongest position to date.
And Russia's Vladimir Putin is under serious pressure, losing men faster than he can replace them.
I'm Kylie Morris.
And I'm Latika Burke. Welcome to Global Roaming. Kylie, we have a great guest lined up today.
Well, we have. Look, we have been talking about Ukraine for years on this program, obviously, as we should have. And I've got to say there is a very high standard of analysis, particularly from within Ukraine, about what the strategic and security objectives are, what's being achieved. Also from Russia watchers who look at the politics, you know, what is happening, what does this mean for Putin's position? And of course, there's always a geopolitical edge to this, who's helping, who's not, and why. But not everyone gives analysis as keenly as our guest today. She is incredibly well-connected. I mean, you know her, Latika. Tell us a little bit about her background.
Yes, Kylie. I met Jade McGlynn in Kharkiv. I was introduced to her actually about halfway through the dinner, and I realised very suddenly who it was. She is the Jade McGlynn I listened to commentating on the battlefront about Ukraine and have listened to her for years and years. She's a very renowned academic and she studies war at King's College here in London, speaks fluent Russian and Ukrainian and spends a lot of time on the front in eastern Ukraine. So I knew there was no one better to discuss what has been a really, really big shift in the war in Ukraine. And I think maybe one that has gone a little unnoticed because the world has stopped paying as much attention to this conflict as they were, say, even last year, but definitely 2 or 3 years ago. And very quietly, but very rapidly, Ukraine has made some stunning successes on the front line. For months now, they have been killing Russian men faster than Vladimir Putin can replace them. That brings in all sorts of tension points for the Russian Federation. And secondly, they've developed their own capability to strike at Russian logistics around 200 kilometres from the front line. And that's really important because they don't need US intelligence to carry out those strikes. And those strikes, taking out logistics, can do enormous damage to Russia's ability to wage war against Ukraine. So that's the environment Ukraine's in. And there is no one really better than Jade McGlynn to take us through it. Here she is now. Jade McGlynn, I think the last time, actually the first time I met you was in Kharkiv and we were having dinner with a very high profile commander in Ukraine. That was in February. And I think it's fair to say that the situation on the ground in Ukraine is vastly different now. How different is it and why?
I think there's two aspects. The first of all is just the change in morale. Morale is so much higher than that very enjoyable and interesting dinner in February, but also it was the end of a really, really difficult winter. And naturally, spirits rose almost with the 1st of March and the coming of spring. At the same time, there was a new Minister of Defence, Mykhailo Fedorov, who has introduced a number of long overdue changes, both in terms of how current soldiers who have been fighting some of them since 2022 are treated, which was probably not appropriate. previously, but also a much more project-based and tech-minded approach that's starting to have real results. There have also been strategic changes, such as the decision to focus efforts on the Middle Strikes campaign, which is a strikes on Russian logistics, command and control points that are located in the occupied territories of Ukraine. And that's been having incredible results combined with, you know, a number of very clever moves from Fedorov in terms of cutting off Russians' access to Starlink. So all of this combined, it's not just one thing. There have been a number of things that have come together to both bolster the Ukrainian presence and, of course, the sun and some warmth never does any harm either to morale.
And so does that mean Ukraine is making territorial gains? Or what's the biggest way we can see the effect this has had on Russia versus Ukraine and the positions of strength?
This has become a really controversial point, and I think in a way it speaks to how difficult it is to map, you know, where front lines are, because front lines gives, at least to me, this sort of First World War trenches idea. And there are trenches, but ultimately what you're talking about is a 30-kilometer kill zone either side of what we might call the zero line. So to talk about, you know, who is taking more territory or less territory, it can sometimes give a false impression. It is fair to say that Russia's ability to advance has vastly gone down. Some have argued, for example, the ISW has argued that Russia has lost territory, but I think we have to be very careful, and that's not a criticism of ISW. I think it's just a comment on how difficult it is to really measure who holds which territory in such a fluid war.
Jade, I should just jump in. So the ISW is the Institute for the Study of War, isn't it? And they do so much of that mapping work, that kind of granular detail about where the lines are shifting and who's attacking who. We talked about as a spring campaign, the weather changing. Obviously, the Russians had hope that that spring campaign would be something definitive for them, but it's failed to bring the kinds of successes they would have hoped. This isn't only about Ukraine's strategic changes, though, and changing morale, is it? It's also about Russian failures. So what's happening on the other side of that account?
Yes, that's a really important point. So first of all, Russia is under increasing pressure across a number of points. So the first is it's not able to recruit as many men as it's losing. So it's not able to replace. And, you know, the way Russia treats its soldiers is as if, you know, they would never run out. But even for Russia, there's a limit, especially since they do not want to call a formal mobilization. Because if there's one thing that Russian public opinion is, which the Kremlin tracks very closely, as odd as that may sound, but if there's one thing that Kremlin public opinion is very staunch on, it is that they do not want a proper round of mobilization, and many Russians are happy to go along with the war provided it does not affect them. So that's one aspect. The second aspect we briefly touched upon about some of the communications issues and information issues. So, for example, with Starlink, but also the Kremlin has given over control of internet communications to the second department of the FSB, which is not a department that is interested in keeping people connected, but it is very much a department that is interested in, you know, spying on everybody. And that has led to blockages and outages of Telegram, which have caused untold problems, self-inflicted, around the front line, you know, where many soldiers are still dependent on volunteers to bring them, you know, drones, to bring them vehicles, and they're not really able to communicate with them anymore. So there have been a number of self-inflicted issues and a number of issues that commentators for a long time were suggesting would become a problem for Russia, but we're starting to see them all rack up now.
And just as a follow to that, in terms of targeting Russian morale, the Ukrainian strikes, for example, that we've seen in recent days against targets in Moscow, really, which, although Moscow, of course, is very heavily fortified, the success of that presumably is not only about what material damage can be done, but also what message that sends the population of Moscow.
Yes, there's a clear psychological impact. And I mean, the Ukrainians must have put in considerable effort because Moscow is very heavily defended in terms of air defense, much more than other cities. And for them to choose to target Moscow in that way is for obvious psychological impact. And bluntly, it had it. You know, you saw, I think there have been quite a lot of videos that have emerged of Russians saying, you know, well, why are you hitting us? You know, what have we done? And of course, it brings home to Russians that they cannot just ignore this war. This is not just some special military operation far away, but something that affects them. And from everything that we see, the more Russians are affected by the war, the less likely they are willing to continue it, which is a pretty logical conclusion for anyone.
Jade, can we go back to the mid-strikes? What technology has Ukraine gathered to enable these? And you said that they take out logistics. Are these strikes that are separate to what we've seen from the attacks on the oil refineries? And again, what technologies are the Ukrainians using to achieve that? And how sustainable are those technologies for Ukraine?
So a few questions to unpack there. They are separate from the attacks on the oil refineries, but in some ways they're connected in the sense that there was a shift in strategy late last year away from purely targeting the oil refineries to targeting the command and control points in middle strikes, which actually is all of the occupied territories except for Crimea. And don't ask me why Crimea is separate. That's just the decision that was taken in the definition. What do they use to strike it? They use fire points, their own obviously production. And for the first time in a really long time, the soldiers have the rather, or the commanders have the rather unusual challenge of having more to strike with than points they have to strike. So actually what has slowed this down has been trying to make sure they have good enough what's called passports, so information about the targets in order to have it approved from the general staff. So you need to have a whole range of different forms of information, so human intelligence, what Ukrainians call technical intelligence, which would cover signals, radar intelligence, and a whole range of other aspects. So that's been the difficulty, is getting high quality enough intelligence, though of course they do receive assistance with that, as I think is well known from US news sites. That's actually been what's been slowing it down, if anything, although it has been a remarkably successful campaign.
So are they missiles or drones?
No, they're missiles.
Okay, so this is actually a big shift, I think, because this is a drone war turning into a missile war.
Yeah, I mean, it's still very much a drone war, and I think some of the contextual reasons as to why it is still a drone war include, some of the manpower issues on Ukraine's side. Not to say that Russia doesn't have them, of course, as well. But yes, Firepoint has been a game changer.
A number of commentators have noted that we now have evidence that Ukraine has, for the first time in 2 years, actually started to regain more territory than it's lost. And that's led to this rush to imagine that the tide is turning and maybe Ukraine can win this after all. Is that an overestimation of what is happening on the ground?
I think it's an unhelpful level of enthusiasm, because we've been here before. And that's not to say that Ukraine is not doing well and that there aren't positive signs. There definitely are. And it's really nice, to have something to feel happy about. But what I worry happens quite often sort of in the media outside of Ukraine is there's then a tendency to sort of overhype what's happened, which inevitably then leads to disappointment. And unfortunately, this is, in my view, going to be a war that goes on for some time to come. And we all need to try not to fall into these sort of, moments of overexcitement, because I think they leave us less well prepared for what is, very much still a marathon with quite a lot to go, sadly.
Jade, how much are these big kind of geopolitical shifts registering for regular Ukrainians? The fact that Putin is visiting with President Xi in China at the moment, for example. The instability now of the British government and Keir Starmer, who has been a key backer of Ukraine and investments in Ukrainian defence. Do those kinds of discussions come to play in the day-to-day of talking about the war in Ukraine?
In Kyiv, yes, certainly in some circles, but not really out east. I got back a couple of weeks ago from Kharkiv and Donetsk regions, from trips around there. And I mean, people just have more important things to be talking about, or, you know, or at least much more visceral things to be talking about. You know, everybody there is in some way involved in the war effort. They're trying, you know, to find out, you know, where they can get money for this new batch of drones, or how they can update their electronic warfare, or even just how they can bring humanitarian aid, you know, to some of the elderly people, let's say, who are in the villages that were deoccupied. So I think people are much more involved in the day to day. The nitty-gritty, if you will, the real aspect of the war rather than the geopolitical discussion. And I remember particularly after President Trump was re-elected, I spent quite a lot of time in East Ukraine because it was the only place you could be where you didn't have to discuss President Trump.
You found the only sanctuary in the world, and it's a war zone. Jade, I have a question for you about what lessons do you think we all should take from the way that the war is being fought in Ukraine? I, for one, am very skeptical about this idea that the future of warfare is drones and drones alone, and it's all drones, 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 because you and I will vividly recall that great dinner we had with Achilles, and he was saying, look, half the drones we're getting are absolute crap, and I don't use them, and I don't want to use them, and I'd actually prefer to build my own. And actually the cycle of drone making is now like days. Where do you think the West should and could learn from Ukraine, and what should they not learn from Ukraine?
I would tend to agree with you. I will make a quick comment about the drones, which is that I think in particular, Achilles was referring to Western-made drones rather than Ukrainian. And I mean, that's a whole other topic. But, you know, Western companies coming out and say, flying something around in Lviv and saying tested in Ukraine, you think, well, why don't you try it in Donetsk region? I could make something that flies in Lviv. But I think more broadly, though, I really do agree with your point. I think what we need to learn from them most of all is a mindset, actually, much more than any particular technology. Of course, there are technological innovations that are important. It's, you know, important for us to make sure we have enough people on the ground to be learning from those innovations, because Russia's certainly learning from them. The idea that Russia doesn't learn is not true, sadly. I wish they didn't.
And China is learning too, right?
China's learning. Exactly. And I mean, China is so active in the occupied territories of Ukraine, you know, digging up all of the minerals, setting up all of these locations. The Chinese are very connected with the Russians. You know, they're obviously using their considerable influence now over Russia to try to get access to as much technology. I mean, if you think about the Yasen submarines, for example, that's technology that China doesn't have that it would like. It'll be interesting to see if it comes up during Putin and Xi's discussions, because submarine technology is probably something the Americans would rather the Chinese did not get hold of. So there are all these different aspects, and we've seen with Iran too, the technology and information sharing. So in terms of the main lesson, I think that the West should, and to be honest, certainly for Britain, has not taken, is that this is about a mindset of not obsessing about creating some wonder weapon, but thinking, what this is the problem, what's the best solution we can make as cheaply as possible that gets the job done? That's the mindset that I think has taken Ukraine so far.
I'm Kylie Morris here with Latika Burke on Global Roaming, and we've been talking to Jade McGlynn, who is a Russia-Ukraine analyst. She's from the King's College in London, but she's really bringing us up to date on what's happening, I guess, on the battlefield, but also in the minds of Russians and Ukrainians. What's the psychological state of both sides as they see Ukraine make some pretty significant advances in the war? Jade, is there a danger for Ukraine in the optimism, though? I know that's a strange question to ask, but in terms of maintaining international support, I mean, already in the past week or two, where as people have been reflecting on whether or not the tide is turning in Ukraine's favour, there are lots of opinion columns being written by observers, but also, you know, certainly politically influential commentators saying, well, look, maybe the US doesn't need to support Ukraine. Maybe Ukraine's doing fine on its own. Maybe this is the time to step away, as though the US hasn't already stepped away. But certainly that could be a mindset, change in mindset too, couldn't it?
Yes, I think there is a bit of a danger in it, both for the reasons that I laid out before, that I think then people get overexcited and inevitably that leads to disappointment. It always makes me rather sad how much of a hostage Ukrainians have to be to the whims of public and international support abroad. In the case of the US, and we've seen over recent days a number of positive comments, which are unusual, coming out from, you know, senior American figures, admittedly not the strongest sort of anti-Ukrainian figures, but and also military figures talking about, you know, some things that Ukraine has done well from which the US, you know, needs to learn, or the comments around, for example, the Delta system, which is a sort of information situational awareness battlefield sharing system. But the idea, I think we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves. You know, the support that the US provides in terms of intelligence sharing is still incredibly, incredibly valuable, and no other country would be able to replace that, not Britain and not France. So I think let's not over egg the pudding.
Jade, how do you think the war in Iran has changed things for Ukraine? Because we saw them shift from being a aid asker, I guess if that's a term, to a military enabler in terms of selling their drone interceptors and counter-drone equipment to the Gulf. Did that have any change or bearing on the way that this advance in Ukraine's position now has come to fruition?
I don't necessarily know if it had much bearing on the kind of improvements that we're seeing or the advance in position. I do think that it was a necessary corrective, or perhaps it accelerated a change in Ukraine's positioning that was long overdue. Ukraine, from a European perspective, Ukraine is the best security guarantee we've got. They're the only guys who are able to fight, who are willing to fight. I mean, we're in a lot of trouble without them. And I think what happened in Iran, of course, there were many negatives for Ukraine, not least the lifting of sanctions on Russian oil, at least partial. But some of the positives were Ukraine had a chance to show, actually, you know, you guys are using up Patriot missiles like they're going out of fashion to bring down, you know, sort of cheap Shaheds, and you really need some of our help and experience.
Jay, just finally, do any of these changes that we've been talking about, the kind of successful targeting of military manufacturing, the psychological gains by Ukraine against Russia, do any of these lead us closer to a ceasefire?
Not in the near future. I don't think that Russia is ready to do proper negotiations. I think that the only way that it's possible to have real negotiations in war is when both sides have accepted that they will not achieve their ends through military means. I don't think that that is the mindset or position Russia is approaching this from. I don't think that Russia has given up on its ultimate aim of wanting to control, not necessarily territorially, physically control all of it, but to essentially control politically all of Ukraine until it's forced to accept that it will either have to fight to such a point of exhaustion that it could cause problems domestically inside the Russian Federation. I think until that point, until it reaches that point, I don't think that it will be anywhere near reassessing or being open to good faith negotiation, sadly.
Jade McGlynn, thank you for joining Global Roaming.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Atika, so much to unpack there, but what a guest. I mean, she knows chapter and verse, doesn't she? She's obviously very well connected within the Ukrainian system itself, but also has great analysis and great kind of intellectual capacity to hold all of these things in her mind at once, which I think is what we heard there, her ability to talk us through what's happening in terms of Russian morale, what's happening in terms of Ukrainian troop movements and the expectations and promises that have been made to Ukrainian soldiers, but also, of course, the overlay of technology, which is critical in this conflict. I mean, what did you take away as the most significant aspect of what she said?
I think her caution around the successes that the Ukrainians have had was quite vital, because what Jade, and what I like about Jade's analysis, is that she's not just a Ukraine booster. Obviously, she's on the right side of all things, but she applies rigor to all her analysis. And so I think you get a very accurate picture. She spends just about, I think, every month on the front line in the East. She also speaks fluent Russian and Ukrainian. And so she has got a wealth of experience in talking to soldiers, to units on both sides. She knows this stuff inside out. And she is one of the more sophisticated analysts, I think, of the mood on both sides. And her caution, I think, was the most interesting part to me, because my overall assessment, Kylie, is that Ukraine's advances are putting them in a position to be at the negotiating table as opposed to victory. And it does seem that a long time ago we stopped talking about Ukrainian victory. Do you remember at the start of the full-scale invasion when victory was pushing them back to 91 borders, we're going to take back Crimea? Yeah, but, you know, we haven't seen those words come out of President Zelensky's mouth for a long, long time. But now it's interesting that we don't really hear the word victory at all. We hear negotiations, we hear ceasefire, we hear frozen conflict. And I think that's a really important nuance that I picked up in Jade's analysis.
Mm. And I think her reflection that when it comes to ceasefire, all of these advances that we're, you know, picking through on the Ukrainian side, all of which are potentially not game changers, but you put them all together and it feels as though there is a movement in a favourable direction for the Ukrainians. But she really cautioned against exaggerating that and suggesting that that then immediately propels them down the path of a ceasefire. And her point that actually it takes two sides to agree a ceasefire, and unless the Russians have given up on the idea that they can be militarily victorious, then there's no need for them to negotiate a ceasefire. Now, of course, all of these changes, all of the pressure that Ukraine is bringing to bear might have that impact eventually, but certainly we're not there yet. Is that how you heard that?
Yeah, definitely. And I also do think it's important to note that analysts like Jade, and she's not the only one, they are starting to say words like Russia collapse. They are starting to say things like Putin, trouble, mobilization, forced mobilization. You know, these are not dynamics in this conflict that we would have been saying even 2 or 3 or 4 months ago. And so that is, I think, for all her caution, they are enormous gains for the situation to have changed this much. And I also do think that that has led to the shift we're seeing in the way that China is talking about this conflict and the way that the Americans, as she noted, are starting to talk about this conflict. I've got a theory that Xi Jinping and Donald Trump don't like to be on the side of losers.
Well, I think we know that explicitly from Trump, don't we? He doesn't, you know, John McCain, his big problem with John McCain was that he'd been a prisoner of war, that, you know, he likes the guys who aren't captured. So it's been part of his DNA pretty much from the time that he entered office and well before, that he only associates with winners. Now, why he needs to do that and how effective that is a whole other conversation. But yes.
I don't even think we have enough global roaming episodes for that one, Kylie.
No, and I think I think our listeners might find that is a Trump too far, maybe. But Latika, let's move on. So we can protect you from too much Trump, but we always do like to hear what it is you would like us to be talking about and what you think of what we are doing. So please don't forget to write to us. We love your questions and feedback. Our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au.
Yes, thank you, Kylie. And thanks to our producers, Kylie Gray and Rob Kelly. Geraldine and Hamish back tomorrow. They're talking to the New York Times columnist Tom Friedman. Kylie, I think Geraldine's going to be a pig in mud with that one. There could be some Trump, but I'm sure there's a bit more as well. See you.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.